Thanks for tuning in to Best Show Ever, a podcast presented by the Englert Theater. On today's episode, we'll hear from the artisan jewelry maker, Alicia Velasquez, known for her brand, The House of Dakoji. We also talk to local American Sign Language interpreter, Bambi Suits, about her advocacy, career, and best shows ever. Alicia Velasquez is the artisan behind the jewelry brand, Dakoji. Dakoji is the Western Apache word for turquoise, a stone Alicia works with frequently. She believes women carry the same three components of turquoise: strength, beauty, and worth. Since this interview was recorded, the House of Dakoji officially opened its storefront location in Iowa City. Alicia, so glad to have you on the Best Show Ever podcast. Excited to hear a little bit more about what you do today.
Well, thank you for inviting me. I'm really excited to be here as well.
Can you start off by talking a little bit about, paint the picture of how you began to learn your craft? Because what it sounds like is it's a long-standing tradition. It's been passed down through your family. So what did that beginning look like?
So I learned it from my father. The way it looks in our culture is it's not taught to you in the sense of, okay, this is how you do it step by step. The way it's taught in our culture is sitting next to. So for instance, when I was really little, I would crawl up on the chair and sit next to my dad and watch him play. I thought he was playing with beads, but he was, you know, creating his beadwork. So I would sit there and watch him, and then I'll get bored, then I'll leave and come back. And as I got older, I would just sit and observe what he did, and fascinated about one day I wanted to do that. So as the years gone by, you know, just watching him, watching how he created, it just stuck in my head on, okay, this is how you do it. This is how you weave the thread through each bead. This is how you pick up the beads. This is how you create these colors. So it was just something that was taught by seeing. And throughout my life, that's how I've learned, is taught by seeing. When I see something, it's like I gravitate to that, and then I just create. So my dad, I remember also being, when I was little, he would have these mood swings, and I didn't quite understand what that was until I got older. I found out that it was PTSD. So my dad was in the war, and he was a paratrooper in the Panama War. I noticed as I gotten older that when he would do his beadwork, he was a different person. He was calmer. He was more enjoyable to be around. So I learned that beading is medicine. And when I got older, got married, had kids, I have two kids with autism. And so that's been very stressful in our home because the type of autism they have has been very difficult for them and for us as well. So I went into a different state. You know, mentally I wasn't okay because it was just a lot of stress. And I remembered what my dad did. So then I went back to that. I went back to doing beadwork. And so beadwork was my medicine. And that's how I kind of healed myself in the sense, you know, creating these beautiful creations, being able to put that energy into that, and be able to be a better mom for my children.
Oh, that was such a beautiful answer. There's so many gold nuggets in there. I've been thinking a lot. My parents are obsessed with a show about, oh man, I forget what it's called now, but it's about making swords. And at first,
Forge and Fire. My husband is obsessed with that. Yes.
Okay. At first, I was like, what are you guys doing? But they just got so into craftsmanship, mm-hmm. which it has a different sort of feeling in nature than when you just say art or artists, like craftsmen, artisans, the slowing down and the doing things by hand and the meticulous and repetitious nature of things. Yes. And the way that even just watching that can be soothing. So I can only imagine.
Yes. Exactly.
How therapeutic it is to actually do that work.
And then, and that's the story behind the beadwork. I started silversmithing not too long ago, and that's another form of art that I do. And in that sense, I had a lot of elders throughout my life show me those techniques. My dad did not show me silversmithing, but he was a general contractor, so he was a craftsman himself. He created these amazing things out of wood, out of metal, just because he was in that field. But the elders from different tribes and different states that I lived in showed me how to create these pieces by using traditional techniques because their children did not want to learn how to be a silversmith. So they found that I was so eager to learn. Then they said, okay, we're going to give this to you. We're going to show it to you. We're going to hand it down to you. So to have those techniques handed down to me is an honor because usually you hand them down to your children. So for them to hand it down to me, it's like, wow, you accepted me into your family. So it's just amazing. And so that's how I carried on those traditions with silversmithing.
Oh, beautiful.
Thank you.
I'd love to hear more about your relationship with turquoise. You have turquoise in your hair. Turquoise is a big part of your brand. And it's obviously more than just a stone.
Mm-hmm.
And it has a lot of meaning for you. So can you talk just a little bit about what the meaning behind it and what turquoise gives to you?
Okay, so my dad would always use the color turquoise in his beadwork. Always use that color. So as a little girl, I remember seeing that color. And so when the time came for me to brand and to come up with a name for my business, it was no brainer, but I didn't want to call it turquoise, you know, because everyone uses that word. So I decided, okay, well, let me go back to my roots. Let me go back into the Apache culture and find out how to say turquoise in that language. And when I found it, I just fell in love with how it sounded, Dompigi. It sounds so, people think it's French, which mm-hmm. makes sense, you know, but it's just something about it just sounds so bougie, I guess you can say. That's the right word.
Yes, girl.
But it's something about it. It just comes out bougie, you know. But turquoise, yeah, my dad would use the color a lot in his beadwork. And, you know, turquoise represents so much. And in my About Me page on my website, I kind of break it down into three components. How turquoise, I compare turquoise, women to turquoise. How turquoise is strong, it's beautiful, and it has value. And I break that up into three parts and explain it that turquoise, the way turquoise is created is almost like how we are created. When turquoise is formed, it is, there's a lot of empty cavities in the ground. And so when the water and the all the other minerals that are formed fill in those cavities and fill in those holes, and that's how you get turquoise. And as women, we sometimes are empty vessels. We really don't know what's going on, but we fill our life and who we are with things in the world. And sometimes it can be negative and sometimes it can be positive. So it's like, how are we filling those empty cavities in our life? And that's what I want to encourage women. It's like, you are strong, you are beautiful, you have value. And turquoise, you know, the color turquoise changes. There's so many different colors of turquoise. It's not just that blue that you used to see. You have white, you have yellow, you have all these different forms. And as women, we come in all shapes and sizes. As women, we go through so much, you know, having children, being married, or just in society, the expectations that we have, and we have to fight every day to be heard, to be seen. And remembering that we do carry a lot of value. We give birth to children. We create other human beings inside of us. You know, we do so much. Exactly, yes. So understanding that we do have value, you're not just a mom. You're not just, I mean, for a long time, I thought I was just a mom. But no, I am a creator. I created human beings, and I have to raise them and help them into this world. So turquoise has so much meaning, and I can go on and on.
Yeah, I love the way you imbue that messaging of empowerment in your craft. It's in everything you do, empowering mm-hmm. yourself and empowering others. And I wanted to ask, it seems like beyond being an artisan, being a spokesperson and an advocate comes naturally to you. What has it been like having this platform to speak about your experience as an Indigenous woman?
I never thought I would be in this position. I never imagined I would be in this position because growing up, you know, I was taught not to have value. I come from an era, being 42, coming from an era where women were just supposed to be barefoot and pregnant still, you know. They were meant to just cook and clean and do all these things, and that's kind of how I was raised, you know. So I didn't know what value was. I didn't know what beauty was. I didn't know what strength was, because I wasn't raised that way. And it took a long time, and I remember, you know, I had self-esteem issues, and some to this day I still deal with that I'm too dark, or my face is too round, or I'm a little chubby in these areas, and all that stuff, because of going back to the magazine, that's all I saw. You know, growing up, I didn't see women that looked like me. I saw, you know, Cindy Crawford and all those models that it's just like the girl next door is what they called them, and I wasn't that. So it was that identity crisis, not seeing people who looked like me in that platform on TV. So having this platform now, it's like remembering how I was when I was in elementary school, how I was when I was in high school, and what I wish I had, you know, someone to tell me. I wish someone would tell me that I had strength, that I had value, and to believe in myself. You know, I wish I had those things. So having this platform is just like, no, you know, you are beautiful. You do have value, and you are stronger than you think you are. And we just, as women, we have to be reminded that, you know, being 42, you know, it's hard. Our generation is, we've gone through a lot, you know, trying to figure out life, still holding on to the trauma that our parents carried from what they went mm-hmm. through. So I've noticed a lot of women my age have those same things. And so my goal is, that's who I'm speaking to. I'm speaking to that 45-year-old woman, to that 40-year-old woman, saying, hey, remember, you are strong, you are beautiful, and you have value. And I was thinking about that the other day. It's like, I was telling my husband, yeah, my customer, because in business, you have to think about, okay, who's your customer? And you only have one age of a customer. And I'm like, okay, the 45-year-old woman. But my message is not just for that 45-year-old woman. My message can reach the masses, you know, all age level. That little 5-year-old girl who, she can come into my store and see that, oh my gosh, that painting has the same nose that I have. It's a wide nose. Or that art that I see there, her face is round. And I can see myself in that. And that's sharing that to that message that you are beautiful. And it's not just to Indigenous women, but it's to all women, you know, and that message can go, like I said, it reaches the masses. And it's also for men too, because men are beautiful. They are strong, and they do have value. So, you know, it's like, I know my goal is towards women, but some men are gravitated to that. And they're just like, wow, I've never had anybody tell me that. It's like, God, dude, you're strong, you know? You, just because you are sensitive in certain areas doesn't make you less of a man. You know, so, and I think we lost that in this journey of life. We forget who we are with just so much of that TikTok, so much of, and, you know, social media, and people trying to get famous overnight, but they kind of forget going back to the root of, okay, who am I? And I was created for a purpose, and I am going to show that to the world.
I love how everything you're saying makes me think visually of your pieces, your jewelry. They're bold and like sturdy looking, but also beautiful and made of beautiful things.
Yes.
And yeah, everything that you're saying about your vision of what you want to do socially, I feel like visually is represented, which is cool. Sometimes it's not connected like that, but it definitely seems to be in this case. You recently had your soft opening for a physical storefront, and you'll officially be open on November 1st, which at the time we're recording this is a few days away.
Yes. Very nerve-wracking, but yes.
Humming. What is this moment like for you in your career as you look back to where you started and thinking about how far you've come? What does that mean to you?
I'm still in disbelief. I'm still like, I feel like I'm in a dream. I don't think this is really happening. Because when I was little, I would make, you know, Barbie clothes and do all that. I've always loved fashion. I've always wanted to be in fashion. So I would have dreams about it in high school and things like that. And, but then like, you know, I got married and had kids at a very young age. And then when my kids got diagnosed with autism, it felt like my whole life was just shattered because I had two babies that are dealing with something that I didn't understand. Because back in 2000, when they were born, autism was not well researched. People didn't understand. I had doctors that tell me that it was my fault that they have autism, that it's cold mother syndrome. You don't hug your kids enough. It's because you're Mexican. I'm not even Mexican, but because you're Mexican, that's why your kids have autism. It was just, so a lot of that negative energy, a lot of that negative happened. And I felt like, well, then who am I? I'm nothing. I'm just here and I have no passion to do anything. So to see this moment come to life, it's like, it's still, your dreams can still come true. Sometimes you have to go on a long journey to get to where you're at. But one thing that I tell people is never give up on your dreams. It might not happen right away. It doesn't mean that it's not supposed to happen. It's just going to take a little bit longer. And I'm living proof of that. I had to go on this long journey to get to where I am today, to be reminded that all this stuff I went through, I am strong, I am beautiful, and I have value. And so to have this moment come to life is just, I can't believe it. I don't think it's happening. I'm like, okay, I need to pinch myself or I need to wake myself up, but it's just, it's a dream come true. And, you know, I really don't care if I don't sell anything, which is weird. My thing is, I just want to give to the community. I want to let these women know you are beautiful, because that is so important. Jewelry comes and goes. It's going to probably, you know, disintegrate. You never know, you know, but it's like, what am I giving? And I think my message is more important to me than selling my jewelry. But, you know, that helps.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Fabulous and stunning looking things to wear are always a plus. Always a plus. Well, I hope you continue to be loudly successful, because you're definitely inspiring people. I was inspired when I first came across your work. Best of luck with everything. And thank you again for coming on to our little old podcast today.
I'm just so glad to be here. I am honored that you chose me to speak.
We'll be right back in conversation with Bambi Suits after a word from our development director, Katie Roche.
Did you know that you could be promoting your business, organization, or event to Best Show Ever podcast listeners by placing an ad here on the show? Sponsoring Best Show Ever or other Englert programming ties your brand to a local legacy, the Englert Theater. And your support of the Englert now means more than ever before. In 2020, we experienced a significant revenue shortfall brought on by the COVID-19 pandemic. Through this financially tumultuous time, we're producing new digital productions, including this podcast, our Stages concert series, and Witching Hour Festival, all to inspire positive community growth through the arts. Packages range from $100 on up. Our investment in the arts community is only possible with support from sponsors like you. And art supporters are known for supporting those that support the arts. Visit englert.org/sponsorship for all of the information about how to advertise. I mean, you're listening right now. Place your ad here, englert.org/sponsorship.
Bambi Suits is an American Sign Language interpreter based in the Quad Cities. She works full-time with K-12 students and also freelances and volunteers when time permits. You may have even seen one of her recent interpretations in Iowa City with Witching Hour 2021, or at the Angel Bat Dawood Show at Trumpet Blossom presented by Feed Me Weird Things in Black Clapton. Bambi, thank you so much for coming on to the Englerts podcast today. I'm excited to chat a little bit.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to talk about my profession.
Yeah, let's do it. First question. How and why did you begin to learn American Sign Language? Where did that journey begin?
Okay, well, it actually began way back when I was like 9 years old. I got a children's encyclopedia, and in it was the manual alphabet in ASL. And so that was the beginning of my ASL journey. But I did not officially begin to study the language or the culture or the people that the language belongs to, you know, which is the deaf community, until I was in college. And I, like any college student, was exploring what to do. I majored in nursing at first, and then I found out that we had to dissect rats in the biology course.
That'll do it.
I have been I've been a dissection protester since fifth grade, so not good, you know, not my area of expertise to dissect anything. So I went to speak to my advisor, and they asked what I was interested in, and I said, I've always wanted to learn American Sign Language. And she said that a community college in Bettendorf, which was just right across the river from where I lived in Moline, had an American Sign Language interpreting program. Back then, they always used to be called ITPs, interpreter training programs. So that's how I started. I think I was like 18 or 19 at the time, and started going to Scott Community College by way of Black Hawk Community College as a co-op student, and started studying the language and learned that there was, like I said, a culture and a people attached to that language.
What would you say have been key observations or lessons that you've come to know and understand in your time as an interpreter and ally for the deaf community?
Lip reading does not work. Most hearing people assume that deaf people can read lips, but, you know, there's just kind of like a general statistic out there. I don't have a source to back up what I'm going to say, but, you know, the statistic states that lip reading is like 20% effective. If you look at like the mouth morphemes of the words like bat, fat, and cat, and then you're expecting a deaf person or a hard of hearing person to lip read, that's just not a thing. Mm-hmm. That's not a possibility. So I would say that is one key observation. Also, just maybe telling a deaf person, oh, I'll just tell you later, it's not important right now, as a hearing person, that is not a kind thing to do, and it is not a wanted thing. You know, a deaf person doesn't want to be told that. And I don't want to speak on behalf of deaf people and say that, but in my experience, you know, the more information you can give up front, that's going to create more clarity in communication. And, you know, that's another observation as an interpreter. Communication is literally the most important thing in anything that we do. Hmm. So many times something could be solved so simply if there was just clearer communication, clearer instruction or direction at the beginning. You know, sort of back to that lip reading thing. We can't assume that everybody communicates the way that we do, or that they're understanding us when we are communicating with them. We kind of have to step back and make sure that that communication process is actually unfolding the way that it's supposed to, so that both parties can understand and receive the message at the same time.
Hmm. Ease of communicating is something a lot of us take advantage of. Don't think about at all, like, the difference that that makes.
I think we definitely take it for granted. Yeah. As hearing people, we take for granted, like incidental learning, for example. Like you and I, growing up in hearing households, we're used to learning and hearing anything that's going on around us. We are always included in a conversation, even if by accident, because we're allowed to eavesdrop.
Hmm.
Well, my experience as working as an educational interpreter and working with deaf children who are born into hearing families that do not sign.
Mm.
Those children often suffer language acquisition delay, and that can be detrimental in so many ways.
Hmm. What would you consider to be the most difficult part of being an ally?
Keeping my mouth shut. as a sign language interpreter, I am very limited by my role in any experience. I must be very observant and careful about my role because that's kind of like the butterfly effect. I could change something by speaking out, or I could create a situation where the hearing person perceives me as the deaf person. And so if they don't like me, then they're projecting that onto the deaf person. Mm. There's so many layers in what we do. And that is the hardest part. It is the hardest part for me and for several others who are outspoken people and kind of political or politically minded or struggle to keep their opinions to themselves. It's very difficult for me to witness an injustice or see a need going unmet and not be able to say something about it, not be able to bring light to that situation. That's become extremely difficult for me as an educational interpreter when there are children involved and there are things going on and I have this window into their world. I'm not necessarily supposed to see those things. I'm not necessarily supposed to know that's going on. And that's true for anyone who works in the education system. But as an interpreter, when you're actually working as the voice or for that child, you see a lot of things that are difficult to digest, you know, difficult home environments. And like I said, everybody working in education goes through that.
Moving into the actual what you're doing while you're interpreting, and I'm curious about music because you like music and I like music and the Englert loves music.
Yep,
and
absolutely.
I got the pleasure of seeing you interpret a musical show at Trumpet Blossom recently, and I was seriously so captivated by the way that you and the people you were working with were conveying the emotion and movement of the song and the instruments. And I can only imagine how hard it is to, it's kind of like what they say, like dancing about architecture. Like how do you communicate music that way? But you were doing it, which was incredible. So I guess how does that work? Like, what's going through your mind? Does it feel like you're performing?
Sometimes I'm not sure how it works either. and sometimes I'm not sure. I can only hope that the interpretation was clear and that I did justice to the speaker and made sure that the audience received the message, you know, in the in the intended language. That show at Trumpet Blossom was such an honor for me. I have been a member of, you know, this community, the music community in both Iowa City and in the Quad Cities for as long as I can remember. You know, when you grow up in those communities, everybody knows everybody and, you know, all the venues are kind of connected in some capacity. And so for me to like be able to interpret a show like, you know, in our scene at Trumpet Blossom, for me, that was like Carnegie Hall or something, you know, like that was amazing. Like that was like, that's exactly what I want to do. Like being able to mesh like this part of myself with this part of myself.
Yeah.
All the while providing access for the deaf community. In these places I like to be, in these spaces where things are happening, because this is what's really important to me, right? This music, this art, these venues. But I want to share that with the deaf community. You know, I want deaf community members to be able to walk into the Englert on any night that a show is happening, just like anyone else, and be able to just roll up and there's an interpreter and there's the show and it's full access all the time. Well, the show at Trumpet Blossom, that was the first time in my experience that that has occurred. Mm-hmm. And guess what? It worked, you know. It was a wonderful event, and it was on the Tales of Pride, which was just a super fun experience. But, you know, you're asking me about like the emotion and, you know, the feelings behind interpreting music. Well, I had come from Pride to Trumpet Blossom, to this incredibly intimate show. She's something else, you know. She's an incredible performer, you know, an incredible jazz musician and just trying though to convey what she was saying was a challenge. And my teammate and I, my favorite teammate who I love to work with, was there with me that evening, Ms. Epiphany Dondle. So being there with her was wonderful, because at one point I know that the performer was conveying the cries of children who were lost or something to that extent that was on one of her videos. And so Ms. Dondle was going to make sure that she was the one who was interpreting that, because as a white woman, I'm not about to get up there on a stage and try to like emote in American Sign Language the feelings of Black mothers who have lost their children the way the performer was conveying it. So that goes back to being sensitive and aware of who you're sending to do the job. Mm-hmm. You try to convey the feeling and the message of the speaker. I'll use speaker as a generic term, you know? So,
yeah.
And I take that pretty seriously. You know, we do have to take acting as interpreters.
I actually thought that because I interviewed recently a musical conductor, Melise Brunet, and she said it feels a lot like acting, the way she has to communicate without saying anything, just using her hands and her body. And that kind of made me think, like, yeah, these ASL interpreters are seriously, the facials, like the body language, everything is like a performance, which is really impressive. And to be interpreting at the same time, something people are saying live is like, that's like patting your head and rubbing your tummy like times 1,000.
And I, you know, I've been studying the language for a very long time. I would never consider myself fluent, because the language is always changing and growing, just like English. Every time the teenagers out there invent a new word, what is it in ASL? How do I, so, you know, how, whenever it was, how do I, skirt was one for a while, and then yeet, you know, so what is this and how do we sign it? And so I'm like, yeah, my job is a lot of times like having to help people figure out what slang means, you know, and where it comes from. Because if you work in a junior high or a high school, mm-hmm. like we do at times, you're going to need to know those things. But, you know, so that's completely different than the you know, the musical part of interpreting. It's completely different.
Okay, my final question is, best live show you've seen in Iowa City? Seen or interpreted?
I wish that all of our promoters were having interpreters up in these shows so I could tell you what my favorite interpretation was. But,
yeah.
You know, we're getting there. I'll give you a few if that's okay.
Okay, go for it.
The Big and Tanya's at the Englert was incredible. Such an amazing show there. Such an important band to me. Iron and Wine.
Got the shirt on.
At the Englert. That was a long time ago. That was a great show. Sharon Van Etten at the Mill.
Ooh, yes.
That was an incredible show. Part of Mission Creek, I think, back in the day. Vietnam at the Mill. That was an amazing show. The Microphones at Gabe's. I literally sat on the floor of Gabe's for a show, like, of Montreal. At Gabe's, yes. It was an incredible show. Evan Dando at Gabe's. Like, I have Jenny Lewis and Desi Parasitos at Gabe's. Like, I have a difficult time narrowing down.
Dang, yeah, you got a whole list.
the Black Keys at, I forget the name of the room, but at the college.
IMU, maybe?
That was a great show. Just so many. Iowa City's always had an active, amazing scene. And I'm not even naming all the local bands that, you know, I would love to talk about.
Well, thank you so much for coming on again today. We're so excited to be partnering with you more. And yeah, it's been a pleasure.
So thank you for having me here. It's been a nice conversation. Also, I would like to say that if anyone is interested in learning more about what's going on in the Deaf Community Daily, there is a lovely news site called the Daily Moth. And, you know, they have all of the things, Facebook, Instagram, all of it. but it is news presented every day in American Sign Language.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Thanks for that. Our song of the week is Anyway from the Ottumwa-based pop-punk group TV Cop. The band is currently working on the masters for their new record, but to get your fix in the meantime, check out their page on Bandcamp for lots of other great tunes. Heads up, this song contains some explicit language, so if you got some kiddos around, it might be time to pull out the earmuffs. Here it is, Anyway, by TV Cop.
Sitting here, wasting my brain away. I'm just staring at a TV screen. Nothing good's on, but I'm watching it anyway. Alone again, too high on a Saturday night. I'm super tired, but I'm gonna put up a fight so I can finish this episode of Brooklyn Nine-Nine.
Most for your money can help you relax. With power checking from Midwest One Bank, you may earn higher interest and ATM fee refunds by simply receiving electronic statements, making at least 15 debit card purchases that post and clear, and making at least one direct deposit, automatic debit from a third party, or bill pay transaction post and clear each qualification cycle. See MidwestOne.bank for details. Enjoy simply better banking from Midwest One Bank. Member FDIC.
Support for this podcast comes from Friends of the Englert. To learn more, visit englert.org/friends. Ongoing support provided by the National Endowment for the Arts and the Iowa Arts Council, a division of the Iowa Department of Cultural Affairs. And by the United States Regional Arts Resilience Fund. Phase 1 is an initiative of Arts Midwest and its peer United States Regional Arts Organizations, made possible by the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation.